Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast. I'm Dale Fung, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Val Matthews. Hello, Val.
Hi, everyone. How are you going?
It is my great privilege to introduce our guest on this episode, who is an exceptional leader in the PMO and project environment. She is also a devoted wife and loving mum. Welcome to the pod, Caroline Patterson.
Hello. It's nice to see you both.
It's brilliant to see you. Yeah. And we're absolutely stoked to have you on this pod. We could cover every topic on projects and PM with Caroline, and we probably will cover many of them. However, the key insight we're speaking to Caroline about today is probably going to focus around work-life balance, and in particular, building her career in a pressurized project leadership role while still being present for her family. Before that, though, here's Val with Caroline's bio.
Thanks, Dale. So, Caroline, you get to listen to this while I do it. So, born in country New South Wales, Caroline has a strong connection to Australia. As a first-generation Australian, she has encountered many challenges, each one helping to build a level of resilience and tenacity that has served her well over the years. As an educator, a teacher, and a creative, Caroline fosters an environment of out-of-the-box thinking, encouraging critical challenge and learning, working to ensure these attributes form the fabric of every team she builds. Caroline began her project management and transformation career in Australia, working for a large engineering organization delivering aerospace and simulation projects for the Australian Defence Force. This was the gig she didn't have the experience to do, but was thrilled when the hiring manager saw potential and took a risk. This experience helped shape her understanding of what good leadership is, and as she has developed her own career, she continues to find opportunities to give people a go, even if they may not look like the fit, the requirements of the role. During her early years in the project delivery landscape, she was given the opportunity to build the first PMO for the organization, and under the mentorship of some very experienced PMO and PMs, she then went on to expand the function to build satellite PMOs across other sites all over Australia. This then led to an exciting opportunity to work on the Bushmaster project. This was an absolute career highlight for Caroline. During this time, she learned new skills in project delivery and manufacturing, the importance of continuous improvement and ensuring quality outcomes in line with customer expectations. When an opportunity came knocking in the form of an offer to move into the finance sector, Caroline jumped at the chance to test out her new skills in a new and dynamic industry. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Hello.
that is quite a mouthful. So I struggled on a few words there that, you know, English was my second language and Australian is my first, but I'm sure you understand that.
I do. So I think some of those may have just been spelling mistakes, to be honest.
So. No, it's fantastic flow. And I always get jealous when I read everyone else's bio and I feel like I might have to rewrite mine after reading this. But there's so many places, like Dale mentioned, we could start with you because you've got a broad experience. I'd love to start in the defense. So you mentioned an engineering organization delivering aerospace. What was that and how did you get that opportunity?
So it was actually a bit of a fluke, to be honest. And that's why I said the hiring manager took a real risk taking me on. I had just come out of working for a creative arts college, having studied music there for a little while. And then I was a student liaison.
Did you play instruments as well? And you sing?
Yeah, don't ask me to do that now.
I was about to, for the podcast listeners also.
Maybe for the outro at the end.
We'll save it for the jingle.
Maybe a few wines and then you might get a chance to hear it.
Okay. But
so I saw the job application for this role as a project coordinator. And I thought, it's just fascinating, the whole industry of aerospace and simulation, especially in Australia at that point in time. It was still booming to some extent. We were developing a lot of new technology. There was a lot of exciting things happening. So I applied and I got the role. And so the company was called Thales. It's a French organization, but they'd recently purchased the Australian Defence Industries organization here. And I got the chance to learn about project delivery in one of the most dynamic industries at the time. So getting to work on, you know, simulators and on, you know, fighter jets and aircrafts and being involved in R&D activities. It was great. It was just so much fun.
Wow. And obviously there was more to your bio that I kind of missed, but it's really important we get the rest of that in there, because over the past decade, Carolyn, you've moved country, you've worked in different industries, and you've continued to build a career in building teams and establishing high-performing PMOs, which we definitely have to talk about, and then managing projects and leading several major change programs. There's a lot just in that. Yep. The second bit I wanted to talk about, because we had a previous guest, I'm not sure if you heard it, with Holly Patterson around women in engineering, but you're also a strong advocate for women, and you're supported by your husband, obviously, who shares the same views. And there's some challenges, I guess, that you want to talk about today around the preconceived notion that in order to be successful in executive roles, you need to work like everyone else. And particularly, maybe we can touch on some points and some experiences that you have without naming and shaming, I guess. but you are passionate, having worked with you before, and Dale as well. You know, we can definitely advocate the same. And being a wife and a mother whilst pursuing career passions is a huge undertaking. And I think there's a lot of people who listen to our podcasts that probably want to know, you know, you mentioned resilience, but there's probably some other techniques and tools you've got in that, you know, in your repertoire that you could share with us today. So, you know, not boasting you too much, but let's talk about that. So that early day in defense and aerospace and those opportunities you got to spend, you know, being a woman and having that kind of experience and background of resilience, was it enjoyable or was it tough? Was there times when it was challenging?
Yes, yes, and yes. It was definitely enjoyable. And you walk through your early career and you step into an environment where you don't know anything about anything. And having come out of a creative arts space into a heavy engineering environment, and where I was one of, I think it was three women in the entire organization at the time, and one was in HR and the other was in marketing. So
how long ago was this?
It was in the 2000s. It wasn't that long ago.
Wow.
I'm not that old. But I remember one of the first meetings where I was going in as the PMO manager at that time, and I was asked by an individual who walked into the room whether I would be taking tea orders and coffee orders. I was the one chairing the meeting.
Ouch.
So there's a lot of unsaid bias, and then there's a lot of just in your face, we're just going to call it out for what it is.
What did you say to that? What did you say to that?
I pointed him to where the kitchen was and said he could more than welcome to help himself, and then started the meeting. But you've got to take, there's a balance in that as well. We talk about work-life balance, but there's a balance in taking it on the chin and having a laugh with it, but also being clear and saying, you know, that's not appropriate, but I'm going to point it out and go, you know what, there's the kitchen, help yourself. Mm. Now I'm going to take control of the meeting like I've been asked to do. So
yeah.
It's an ongoing thing.
And how far have we come since then? I mean, you know, you, as Val mentioned, you've worked across the globe. You've worked here in the UK. You know, back in Oz, and you've experienced different companies and different climates. Have we come a long way since then? I know you say, you know, early 2000, it wasn't that long ago, but, you know, in 2020 right now, is there still some of that still exists that we need to eke out? Because, you know, habits, and I guess that's what it is, right? It's traditional habits potentially and stereotypes. And those things aren't easy to stamp out necessarily. In your experience, is it slowly finding its way out of the industry?
Yes, it is. I encountered it a lot less in the UK, to be really honest. even working in the transport side of, or the transport sector, which is quite archaic in some regards, especially in the tech piece. But we're changing that. I know that. But I'm going to be really transparent because that's just the way I roll. But I was able to negotiate a compressed working week, taking advantage of flexible working arrangements that the company I work for celebrates. And I was out with some of the leadership and was told point blank that I'm doing an ineffective job as a leader and as a mother because of that arrangement.
What?
So it still exists. It still exists. And
wow.
Then that's the type of thing that I'm still shocked by it.
Mm.
I don't know why, because it is everywhere, but when that is just so openly expressed in such a mean way,
yeah,
you just go, yeah, that's not on.
I'm shocked just hearing it as well. Wow.
I mean, that's crazy. being a guy that obviously, you know, has no issue whether you're man or woman, you know, and not experienced it, it's hard for us to understand. But when you hear things like that, you're like, that it just does, it makes you speechless. Like, you're like, what? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is.
But it still happens.
It still happens
is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, and it's that type of thing whether you work a normal standard week, whether you're a mum or a dad who is taking advantage of flexible working, you shouldn't have to encounter that. Mm. And it's up to us as leaders to actually stand up and go, you know what, that's not right. And
yeah.
I create an atmosphere in my teams where I promote flexible working, and I encourage my team who have children or who have things outside of work to take the time they need to look after that as well, because that makes them want to come in and want to engage and want to do better, which makes us a better and more effective team.
And I always found that difficult to comprehend, and I'm sure Dale will agree, or maybe he won't. Let's tease him out. But that management, or at least some of this kind of old school management, haven't figured out that happy people are productive people. Like, it's a very simple formula. And yep. One of those aspects of happiness comes from that flexibility to be with family and just, you know, service your children and be available to other things other than work and grind and 9 to 5. Is that, why do you think people aren't getting it? Or, you know, maybe it's just a certain few, but they're in senior roles, aren't they? And I just don't understand what's missing. What are we doing wrong here?
I think they're getting it now. I think COVID is going to help a lot with that, for sure.
Awesome.
Because it's made culture change. It's made us rethink the way that we work, the way that we engage, the way that we organize. And I'm actually celebrating it. Don't get me wrong, working full time whilst having children in the house is difficult. But that's where hopefully you've got a support network that you can lean in and manage through it. But yeah, go COVID for that reason.
So what are your kind of top predictions post corona that's going to change? Like, what are the massive things you think that's changed culturally for projects and PMO? Is there any top?
That's a good question. Can we come back to that one?
Of course.
I got to think about that.
You, absolutely. You're so polite about parking it.
No. Really, really quickly, the things that I think are going to change the most is predominantly around team dynamic and the way that we communicate. I think we're going to become better communicators. And as a PMO, that's essential, because what we effectively do when we're in that role is knowledge sharing, is taking information, transforming it into management information so that decisions can be made. It's all about communication. It's going to help us actually build better relationships, because you need to rely on each other in a different way, and you can't take people for granted anymore. And I think those are some of the things. I think from a technology perspective, the data side of things, the reliability of and the quality of what we're putting into our project management systems, what we're putting into our planning, and all of that goodness that comes from taking a moment to pause and do this well, I think those are things that we're going to really benefit from coming out of it.
Yeah, I love it. I completely agree. Dale, did you have any thoughts on
Yeah, no. So just earlier you kind of said, do I agree or disagree with, you know, sort of the more traditional dinosaur leadership, if we can call it that. The funny thing about that is dinosaurs are now extinct. So that's a good thing, I guess. I'm sure in time we'll have those sort of traits and characteristics stamped out. But also I think it comes down to trust as well. If you don't trust your staff, if you don't trust your leadership, then you're going to want to micromanage them. And that also comes down to, I guess, yourself, because if you're not creating that environment that your staff and your colleagues can work in a trusting manner, in an open, transparent manner, then you're not going to sort of allow them that space. And so, yeah, I do agree with what you're saying. And I think trust is a hard thing. It's quite interesting. I know, you know, we've had a few people, guests on here that, you know, we've spoken about Simon Sinek's books, and most recently, you know, Leaders Eat Last. I've been kind of the audio book on that. And he talks about how, you know, we had the two great world wars and the resilience out of that generation, but then the baby boomers came along and kind of messed it up for us a little bit. And we're trying to fix that now. So it's quite an interesting read, it gives you a bit of insights, I guess, into what we're inheriting as kind of the next generation of leaders coming into those roles. So I guess if we wanted to empathize, not just downwards, so to speak, but also upwards to those before us, there's a bit of empathy to going, well, they didn't know what they didn't know. But hopefully we can be, you know, that sort of conscience, if we can call it that, to kind of show them the way. But and maybe the podcast is a way to go about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like the Tony Robbins analogy of a negligent parent who says to a disturbed child, he says, you know, if you blame your parent for everything that went wrong in your life, you have to blame them for everything that went right. And I think he was bang on there. Yeah. And there was an interesting quote I read. I don't know where I got it from, but I'm keeping it. I can't claim it, but I can, you know, if anyone knows the credits, please let me know in the link. Which is on point with the leadership style you're talking about, Carolyn, which says, people don't care what you know until they know you care. And you talked about trust, Dale, and I think that's just like bang on. I love that. So feel free to steal that and use it everywhere, because I think it's just a great way to, wins hearts and minds, and quite rightly, post-corona, hopefully there's a lot more empathy and perspective and patience, and priority is reset in a way that allows people to realize that they don't all have to be hustling in at 8 o'clock in the morning on the same bloody train. Just chill out. The work will get done. Yes. Because good people do good work. And they don't need to be there on the Henry Ford time clock, you know, so good stuff. I mean, we got straight into this podcast. We didn't mess about at all, Dale. Straight on the rail tracks. But I wanted to talk about something creative and fascinating and fun that may elude a few people. And that's probably to start with a definition from you, Carolyn, and then a bit of your experience around the word transformation. It's a big word. And I've heard a lot. It's used a lot. It's thrown about quite a bit. It can be politicized. It can be used in a negative connotation. It can be used as a positive drive. What's your take on transformation from a definition perspective, but also from a like experience? What's PMO's role in that transformation space?
Transformation is not continuous improvement.
Ooh.
I'm just going to put that out there. It is not.
What's the difference? What's your difference?
Continuous improvement means you are somewhat remaining the same, that you're improving. It's a tweaking. It's like what you would think of with a like a race car, right? You go in for performance tuning. It's improving the performance of the vehicle. That's continuous.
But it's the same vehicle, effectively.
The same vehicle.
Gotcha.
Transformation means you change the whole car. You have new engine. You have new suspension. You've got everything else is different. Transformation means it is no longer the same. And that could be.
But is the outcome the same? Like, as in, are you still racing? Would that be contextually?
Yes. Yep. The outcome could still be the same.
Gotcha.
But it might be better. Well, it should be better.
Absolutely. I love that. That's so good. That's a nice little nugget there.
No use transforming if You're doing the same thing.
So simply, it's a different product to get there. Is it faster, or is there something else that?
No, I think you're getting caught on the car analogy. Just to
I'm stuck on the car thing. I'm sitting in the car right now. Just imagine going around, and then I upgrade to an Elon Musk SpaceX rocket, and then I'm back with you. My follow-on question around that was kind of what's PMO's role in transformation? Is it still their role?
I think PMO has to transform itself. I think the way in which we have run PMOs to date needs to undergo a radical transformation. And that's the only way that it's going to remain relevant. As technology changes, as ways of working changes, the PMO at its core will still perform the function of monitor and control. It will still perform the function of ensuring that planning practices are in place, good project management is in place, but its role needs to be results driven. We need to stop looking backwards as a PMO. And so if the PMO wants to transform, it needs to be predicting what's coming and leading ahead and charging ahead and making way for others to do the same. And that's the way that I think we can ensure that PMOs continue to be relevant. We become the ones that pave the way for others. We set the tempo.
I like it. We set the tempo, Dale.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. We do set the tempo. Also, I think alluding back to kind of some of the previous parts is sometimes we're not allowed to, in terms of, the dinosaur leadership style. But if we're allowed to, we touch every single area of the business and we can set the tempo for whether it's transformation, delivering projects, whatever the case may be. But if I may, Caroline, I wanted to sort of touch back a little bit on your bio, to perhaps just before you made the transition from sort of your creative side into projects. I mean, just having a look at education, you've done teaching, you've done contemporary arts. I believe you're currently doing interior design. How do you borrow from that creative side into the PMO? Because some people that look at PM go, well, it's all numbers and logic, and it's cost and it's schedule and it's risk, and those are all just numbers and stuff. How do you get creative with PMO? Is there anything that you can bring across?
Oh, 100%. Yes, there is. The creative lens allows you to problem solve in a different way. It allows you to apply things like design thinking in a scenario where it might not normally fit or people don't expect it to fit. I remember some of the first meetings that I had with groups of aeronautical engineers and people like, they're not creative. Engineers aren't creative. How could you go from being surrounded by artists and musicians to technical people? My response was they are actually some of the most creative people I've ever met, because you give them a problem, you give them a design, and you go make it work, make it happen, transform it into something that actually changes lives or saves lives. That's creativity in motion. And so when I think about the PMO, our role is to do, as you said, is to analyze, is to interrogate, is to provide critical challenges, to do all of those things. But it's also to help problem solve. And creativity gives us that lens. And I think it makes us think outside the box, and we're able to come up with new ways of doing things that might not necessarily fit the mold, but we'll get the results that we need.
Yeah. And I think Dale touched on a good point around allowed, like PMOs need permission. Do you still see that kind of behavior in organizations in 2020 and previous roles?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. And that's where I think there's that old saying that ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
We love
and
that.
I think sometimes we need to do that. And then
I
show the goodness
the
and go, see, look, this is what we were doing, something we prepared earlier type of thing. and you win people over that way. But it's that whole concept of how you drive change and how you bring people on that journey. And as PMO, that OCM, organizational change management component, needs to be part of the DNA of a good PMO, because that means you go from having to ask for permission to actually being having a seat at the table and being part of that decision-making process. And I found that when you've got the PMO front and center, the ones that are chairing those meetings, the ones that are directing the conversation, it goes from that we need to be allowed to we are empowered. And that's a gradual thing, but it comes back to your point earlier around trust. If they trust the people that are involved in that PMO, then that seat at the table is a given.
And in terms of maturity, if we sort of had a bit of a growth curve and, you know, we were basically from infancy to full adult lifehood of, PMOs, and I know this is a tough one to ask, but just globally from your perspective, where are we on that in terms of how organizations view a PMO? Because we've had contrasting views, obviously, before, but the reason we'd like to ask this question again is because you have a different perspective, you have your experiences that you can share with us. And as we you know, ask that same question over and over, we can gain a good expansive view globally as to the situation. So yeah, I'd be interested to know, do you think we're still in our infancy? Do you think we're, you know, maybe teenagers?
I think we've had, in some cases, there's the case of Benjamin Button. You know, there's a going back. like in the finance sector, for example, especially in IT, the PMO performs a very traditional role, and it's slowly changing. So there's a movement, I guess, in the PMO where they're bringing in to the IT sector and finance sector specifically, a lot of people with different backgrounds, so different experience in PMO. So I know I have colleagues in the bank where I work right now who've come out of aerospace, who've come out of defense, where the PMO is built into the ways of working on those projects. And they're bringing in some of that goodness and some of that rigor to IT projects that just kind of have run however they wanted to for a long time. So in that area, PMO was very immature. But then we had Agile come in, and Agile threw the PMO out, and then we went backwards a little bit, because how does the PMO fit in with Agile ways of working? And it's up to us again as PMO to go, no, there's definitely a place for PMO in Agile. So coming back to your question, I know I just rambled a little bit there. But the journey that the PMO is on, it's varied across industries. It's varied across organizations. I don't think we can make a blanket statement to say the maturity level is at this point, because it does depend on the leadership. It does depend on the culture of the organization. And it does depend on the nature of the projects that they're actually delivering as well.
I've got two interesting questions, if I do say so myself. One of them is...
Hold on tight.
Brace yourselves. The first one is, do you think PMO effectiveness is like a barometer of the company culture? One. And have a think about that. And then my second whammy is, should IT not just be a function of PMO? And the reason why I say them is I've been having deep thoughts in all this isolation. It's probably affecting my brain. But I've run this through past a few intelligent people like yourselves, and it's hard for them to debate otherwise, yeah? And probably more on the agreement side than anything else. And
oh, I'm not.
Hey, good. let's debate it. Because it's an interesting topic.
It is an interesting topic. So just to the second one, IT and PMO, the PMO is an enabler of delivery in the IT space, because there's a lot more in IT that doesn't touch projects. And unless the definition of the PMO changes, then IT and PMO are two separate things.
Gotcha.
Because within an IT, you do everything from service management to incident management. You've got that whole ITIL element that's a framework in itself. The execution of projects into that environment has to go through a PMO, has to go through the rigor, but then there's a transfer over into that other way of working. So it's partnership. It's not one or the other.
So you're saying if the identity of a PMO stays as an enabler of project delivery, let's say, then IT wouldn't be part of the function. But if PMO changed into an information digital organization, let's say, and all the low value transactional activities suddenly vanished, which in my world they do. Not that that's reality. Stay with me. Then this is utopia, right? It's fun to go there sometimes as a creative, right? Then theoretically, right? I think there would be a chance for that to happen. I mean, the reason I say that is there's some interesting envelopes overlap where people aren't sure who does what. So, for example, in engineering, let's say BIM, the BIM process, and then therefore the software that's behind it, and GIS, who rolls that out and implements that and then monitors that? Is it the engineering department, which have no idea how to implement and deliver software? Is it the IT department or is it PMO? And I find that really interesting because it touches all elements, right? It could theoretically, depending on the type of project, the type of business structure you've got, organization structure you've got, any one of them could theoretically. But who should? They could,
and they should be able to under the banner of a clear project management framework with clear project management frameworks and ways of working, which are governed by the PMO. I think you've got engineering functions that should be able to run pieces of work. But if they're running them, then there's an accountability that needs to feed back into the PMO. The PMO doesn't need to drive those projects. It just needs to make sure they're being done right.
It's probably the transformation, isn't it? It's a transformation type project itself.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to that whole point of whether or not you're asking me, should engineering deliver projects or should project managers deliver projects? Because that's a little bit different as well.
Or should engineering be delivering capability? And you go, well, is it what type of capability? And you go, well, it's kind of like effectiveness and efficiencies. And you go, well, that kind of sits in continuous improvement, or it sits in transformation, which sits in PMO. So I can see why people get confused, and I'm just clearing my head, but also it's good to debate these things out loud, I think.
Yeah, I think if we're going to be really effective, what we've got to do as a PMO, and this comes back to that results-driven point that I made earlier, is we have to ensure that those functions that are delivering work, regardless of what it is, are delivering it the right way. And that means we're empowering them to deliver. We're empowering them to actually drive change, to transform, to improve. But they're doing it in a manner that is consistent with the ways of working that have been defined by the PMO. I don't think the PMO should do all of it. I think you'll end up with a culture where it's a us versus them rather than this is a partnership. And there's a term that I picked up from previous leadership in the UK, and it's the PMO is the critical friend. The PMO is the one that's sitting there going, this is what you need to do and this is the way you should be doing it. And when you don't do it, I'm going to pull you up on it. And when you do it well, I'm going to cheer you on. And when you need help, I'm going to help you.
We previously used the PMO as a conscience of projects and project delivery. So, absolutely agree with that.
It's the conscience and it's the ass kicker.
There you go. I've been loving listening to this debate, though. And if I may try and act as mediator, I think you both have good valid points. But for me, there's a lot of ifs and buts, and it depends. I think from Val's point of view, if there's no working relationship and no trust, again, between those two departments, then you kind of lean to, well, just absorb it and be part of us, and we can tell you what to do. But if you have a good open working relationship, you've got the framework, you understand how both departments work and you're working closely collaboratively together, then absolutely, Caroline's model and thinking does and will work. I think it's a depend again. It depends on the company, the organization, the culture, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for the most part, if I may add my 5 cents into the debate, I think most companies are moving where various function departments are working more closely together. I think it's becoming less of an issue and lines are becoming more blurred, which is for me a good and a bad thing. As long as you say, Caroline, you have that framework around which those lines are blurred, you can have a bit of parity. But as always, I move on down different rabbit holes and things like that. I want to go back to your bio bit there, Caroline, and just ask you, because I guess we experienced a bit of the same life events at the same time. We both got, you know, children that are of a similar age. And, you know, we like love talking about disruption on this podcast. It disrupts your rhythm, your personal rhythm. It disrupts potentially, you know, some of the career goals you have in mind. You know, certainly for me firsthand, it was quite a big adjustment. You know, all of a sudden you've got this another life form that you have to look after and care for, and it takes up all of your priority, or most of it anyway. But then you also have this drive to, you know, ensure that, you know, you are still achieving your goals career-wise. How was that for you, and what sort of adjustments did you have to make in order to make sure that both kept on track?
It was challenging, to say the very least, and it was a complete and utter, disruption is the right word for it. Because it wasn't something that we anticipated as a family to ever be able to do, to have a child of our own. So that in itself was a complete surprise. I remember the moments of finding out, walking down the stairs with tears streaming down my face, going, I don't know if I'm happy or terrified or what is going on. and I had just been offered a huge promotion to be head of project management for the organization in the UK. So I was like, what do I do here? What's the right thing to do? And it was a question that I had never had to ask myself before. I never had to ask myself, is it this the right decision for me now? And that was like a coming to Jesus moment type of thing, because I went, now I've got to think about something other than just myself and my career aspirations. That was a huge mental shift. And that was quite scary in itself. Because I am quite driven, and I was working really hard to get to that level and to get that into executive leadership. And I didn't want to lose that, but I also didn't want to do something that would mean I wasn't present for my child. So there were a lot of decisions that I had to make, and I was fortunate enough to have leadership at the organization I worked at, where I could sit down and have a really open conversation with them about what was going on. And my concerns around accepting the job offer, knowing I was pregnant, and not wanting to be seen as trying to pull the wool over somebody's eyes. And that was something that my husband couldn't quite understand, because he said, you've been offered this position, you should go for it because you're the right person for the role. Why are you thinking someone's going to think because you're pregnant, you're all of a sudden not fit for it? And that was a preconceived idea and a way of thinking that I had to shift. And I didn't actually realize that was something I believed, that was that it formed part of my own thought process around pregnancy and having a career and all that sort of thing. Because like I said before, I'm a huge advocate for women in the workplace and pursuing their careers despite of having children or not having children, but having things outside of the organization or their career that brings them joy. And so the biggest challenge throughout that period was me. It was getting my head in the game and going, you know what, I can do both. It's okay to do both. I'm not going to be sacrificing one for the other. There will be, you know, there will be contention at times. There will be times where, you know, I will have to work late or I will have to travel for work, and that means that I won't be home to put my child to bed. But at the same time, there are going to be days where I am home and I am with her and I am seeing her take her first steps, and that's fantastic. But I'm still kicking goals at work and I'm still building teams and I'm still showcasing what I'm capable of and learning and growing in that sense. And so that was a period of time in my life where I was going, Caroline, you need to stop self-doubt. You need to go, you are good at what you do. You need to trust in that, and you need to be clear as to what your goals are in as a mum and as a woman who wants to pursue her career. And that's something that it took me a while to actually get there. And it's a good thing that pregnancy is 9 months, you know, because it does give you a little bit of time to get used to the idea. And then when your child actually comes, then everything gets thrown out of the water and you're starting from scratch again. But I have to admit it's helped me become more effective at what I do, because I'm making a conscious decision to pursue my career. This is something that I want to do, and it's something that I enjoy doing. And because of that, it's quite empowering, because it's choice. And when you are in a position where you know you have a choice, and I can choose to do this, and I am choosing to go to work. Yeah, I've got to financially, we all have to work, but I am choosing to pursue a career at an executive level because I believe I can do it. And that belief is something that we all have to have. And it's something that will get challenged, as I had last year. It is something that we have to, as parents, it's not just something that women struggle with, it's parents, it's men, you know, that want to take time off to look after their children. They face a very similar type of challenge. Is my career going to be impacted by taking 6 months off or 12 months off? The other challenge is the coming back to work and making sure that when you come back to work that you're not missing out. And that comes back to the employer and the relationship that you have with your management. It has to do with the policies that your employer has in place. And if your employer is not supportive, not really supportive of you returning to work and wanting to go, I want that promotion that you promised me before I went on my maternity leave. I want to get there. If they're not willing to step in and go, okay, yes, we still believe you're capable of doing that, this is what we need to do to get you there, then find another job, because it's not going to change. That culture will not change, and it will suck the life out of you, for sure. That's quite a hard thing to say, but that's I think that's one of the hard truths, that you find an organization that is going to encourage, that is going to invest in you, regardless of whether you're you've taken 12 months off or you've taken 6 months off or 3 months off.
Yeah, exactly. And it is a partnership, isn't it, between you and the organization. And when you come back, you expect the same treatment, the same level of opportunity as everybody else. And when that doesn't happen, how do you know? I mean, is it when does it become the trigger? When's the time to say, all right, enough's enough, and you break up? Like, what's the trigger for you? Have you got any tips for anyone who might be in that situation, who's in a company that's maybe undervaluing them, you know, not appreciating the work that they put in?
When you stop enjoying it.
Yeah,
when
right.
You've stopped enjoying your work, when you are, yeah. When it becomes a real chore. And it's not even like those little moments where, you know, our work isn't always fun. It isn't. It can be extremely stressful. It can be monotonous. It can be frustrating. It can be all of those things. But the days you enjoy it need to outnumber the days you don't. And when you get to a point in your organization where you are walking into the office dreading it, or you're on the train heading in going, I don't want to be here today, and it starts to affect your mental health, it is time to run. It is time to get out and use your network. Or this is something really practical that you can do. If you get to that point in your career where you are not happy, put a plan in place. The next 3 months, I'm going to build my network up. I'm going to rebadge myself. I'm going to rebrand myself. I am going to tap into people I've worked with before who know what I'm capable of. And I am going to sell the goodness that is me. Then after that 3 month period, then actively start looking, because at that point you would have rebuilt some of the confidence that you've lost, because it does happen. And you would have repositioned yourself in within your network as somebody that is tenacious enough to go after what they want.
No, that's some really good advice there. And anyone listening should, I mean, we've talked about networks before, how valuable they are, maintaining them. And for me, I mean, it's the same. It's most of my roles have come through people I've previously worked with that I have good reputation with, that know the quality of my work, my brand, if you like, my personal brand. And that's an important factor as well. I think, you know, a lot of people, they get, especially if it's early on and they get an unsupporting organization, it can affect them throughout their entire career. And then they think every other organization is like that, when in fact it's not. And, you know, you've just been mistreated. And it's almost like an abused child and then goes out in adulthood and has those same kind of reflexes. So, you know, there's some really good advice around. Yeah, sorry, if you've got something else to add.
I was just going to say, sometimes it's not even the organization. Sometimes it's just the team you're in. Sometimes it's just moving out of that team, staying in the organization you're in, but going, actually, that leader over there is somebody that I want to learn from, somebody I want to grow with. So I'm going to build that relationship with them and then look for work there.
Is it that fragile, Carolyn? Like, is it one poison apple is enough to affect a culture or a team?
It can. It can be. And this comes back to the point we were making earlier around it depends. Mm. It depends. It depends on the organization itself, because, I mean, I'm sure we all can talk about stories where we've had one particular person that made life very difficult for a lot of people, and that shifted the entire culture. It shifted the mood, the atmosphere of the place. I'm a huge believer in things flow from the top. And when your leadership is divided, or when your leadership has got people who are, for lack of a better word, bullies or very nasty pieces of work, then that does start to feed through, because people become defensive. People put their armor up. And then as leaders, you know, you go from managing outcomes and managing teams to deliver really great things to just going, I need to protect my team from all of that. And it ends up actually restricting what they're able to do and how far they're able to go. So yeah, it does depend.
Yeah, it's you know, you touch on leadership and, you know, how everything comes from the top as well. And you kind of spoken a bit previously about, you know, the teams that you kind of set up and what, you know, you provide them in terms of a framework within which to work, Caroline. Are there any sort of maybe a list of 10 golden rules or, you know, insights you can share with those listening to go, well, you know, perhaps I'm setting up a team for the first time and I don't know how this works. I don't know how to set up a team. Something generic that, you know, someone could apply. Or if you want to be quite specific within a PMO organization, that you typically set up to encourage, you know, the things you talk about, transparency, trust, collaboration, et cetera, et cetera. Because we find those little nuggets are quite key. And everyone's list is slightly different because it depends on your strengths and your characteristics. But I'm really interested to hear from your perspective, because I think you're the first one we've had kind of going, I come from a creative background, you know, so it's really, really interesting to hear your point of view.
My top tips for building teams, actually that's not a bad book. I should write something on that. But
podcast in itself.
Yeah. I'll give you guys some credits. No, but I think as a foundational thing, you've got to understand, or you've got to know what the vision and the purpose of the team is. And as somebody who has built teams from scratch, as somebody who has gone in and repurposed teams and reframed it, that is essential. And being clear on that means that when I go through the interview process, or I go, what kind of team do I want? I don't talk just about the skill sets, but I talk about the behaviors. And I think being really clear on what kind of behaviors you want in that team. For me, I encourage my team to share their opinion, to be vocal, to provide critical challenge. I like there to be pointy bits to the team, because that's what makes us sharper. It's what keeps us on point. Excuse the pun. And when I'm building my teams, the first thing is there going to be a little bit of friction? Because if there is, that's great. I want people in my team who balance each other out. I know within myself, I like to get things started. I am full of energy, optimistic, yep, we can do this. This is the way we're going to go, and I will want to go full steam ahead. And I need people on my team that will slow me down a little bit, that will go, Caroline, have you considered this? And so I look for people in the team that will complement my own, I guess, blind spots, that will help fill those. I look for people who are well-rounded, who are adaptable. And that is because of, regardless of whether you're PMO or not, you have to adapt. You have to be comfortable with that. So I think I've not given you like 10 clear points there, but just generally, generally speaking, you can see how my brain works a little bit. It's just like it's like a bit of a mind map that just takes over. But being clear on the purpose of the team, and then understanding that, I can then look at the type of the DNA, the character of the team, and then I look at the skill sets required to actually accomplish the mission.
How difficult or easy is that to get right, that mix and encouraging those sorts of behaviors? Because, you know, a lot of our behaviors are sort of, you know, we brought up a certain type of behavior, and to change that is a bit more difficult if, you know, if you've been driving. I think we've used it before. If you grew up on a farm where there weren't any rules and you could drive the, you know, the old car or the tractor or truck on the farm without any rules from 11, you might develop, you know, bad habits when you come into your driver's license. And behaviors are in a similar way, where, you know, you might have seen or worked in the one company, to Val's point, a certain type of team behavior, and that's the only way you know, and it might be very confrontational and aggressive. How easy or difficult is it to change behaviors in your experience?
It's difficult. And it's difficult because the behaviors are ingrained. It is the outward expression of a lot of years of experience, like you said. You know, there's a whole psychology to it. You've got people with life experience that have shaped those behaviors. One of the things that I am conscious of when I'm leading teams and I'm seeing some of those behaviors, some of those things that don't resonate with me as healthy elements or components of the team, is to try and find out what the underlying cause is. Is that person lashing out and behaving in that particular way and being aggressive and being combative rather than providing challenge? They're actually being combative. I think they're two very different things. And I've experienced team members where it's easy for them to cross into that combative state rather than providing challenge. They're actually arguing and not being constructive and actually being argumentative for the sake of being argumentative. And for me, understanding what's driving that, and a lot of the time it does actually come down to a person's feeling of not being heard. And that's got underlying, you know, there's, like I said, layers. There's a whole psychology around that. It's the onion. And rather than trying to fix the behavior or the outward expression of what's going on, it's the iceberg, right? It's all that stuff that's happening under the water. It's putting them in an environment where they feel that they're being heard. It's positioning them in a particular role that we're able to highlight the good aspects of their character, highlight the fact that they are experts in this particular field, and then that will start to alleviate some of that combative nature. Doesn't always work. Sometimes it is a matter of actually removing that person from the team and managing them out, because it can go from... It can just derail the entire flow of the team. And that's a really difficult thing to do, managing people out. It's not pleasant, because you never want, you know, to hurt people. It's not why we go to work in the morning. You want people to achieve the best they can. But as leaders, we've also got to be responsible for the other people in the team and the organization where we're delivering outcomes for.
Yeah, I completely agree. Do you want to hear a joke? I think it's a dad joke, but how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? And then the answer is none. The light bulb has to want to change. And I guess, you know, it's relative. True. See, it's a good joke. Yeah, see? It's relative because, you know, I love to read and study behavior, and such an element of leadership that there isn't enough attention on it. Like, I mean, it's like mental health. I mean, I'm glad that mental health and well-being is such a positive movement, and there's a lot of campaigning around it now and awareness. But behavioral understanding is important as well. And I always go into a team as similar to you guys. So you're just validating everything that I think in my head, Carolyn. So it's great to hear from you, and I'm sure Dale's the same. But when I go into a team, I know that people aren't their behaviors. You know, behaviors is it's a representation of something. A visual representation of something, or something that's triggered because of something that's happened. And so you just need to understand that you're not always looking at the present. Sometimes you're looking at someone and they're projecting the past. And it's very interesting. As an observer, if you're in a state of curiosity, then it's very difficult if people piss you off. And you can certainly pivot. And I love the idea that a state of calm is the one of the most flexible behaviors we have, but it's one of the hardest because it requires restraint for the response reflex to just punch some guy in the face. You know, not that I would. I'm not saying I would.
Metaphorically speaking, right?
Metaphorically, figuratively.
Thank you for the disclaimer. Of course, in consulting, we don't do that. But I feel like you're banging on a really important door, which is that behaviors and the dynamics of the team are really important to an effective team. And you mentioned in your bio about high performing teams. And whilst I don't like the word so much, like the term, it gets used a lot again. You know, it'd be good to kind of, from your perspective, break down, and I guess it's around behaviors as well, but a little bit more around that high performing team. So you've talked about this, your top tips for building teams, which we look forward to the book. and then obviously vision, behaviors and challenge and having a bit of friction in the team, a bit of competition, a bit of a opposing dynamics.
Not competition.
You don't like competition?
Not competition. Oh. Friction.
No competition at all.
I think competition is dangerous.
Okay, so let's go on to this one because you were very.
I had to call that one out.
That's good though, because then we can delve into this one a little bit deeper. So competition. No, why?
Because everybody is different, and everybody's in that team because of that difference. Because they bring something different to the table. The minute you implement competition, you're asking them to compete for the same thing in the same way. And I've got people in my team that are the most analytically minded individuals, and they are brilliant at that. I could not put them in a position where they're having to compete with somebody who isn't like that, who's really great at the big picture stuff and really great at dreaming stuff up, to go, there's a level of competition there. So I'm saying, you're not as effective as this person because this person's getting recognized by all of this leadership, when they're actually in the background doing a stellar job. I like friction in the sense that you're asking the questions. You're going, but why are we doing it that way? Why is it this? Why is that the
best? Yeah, I get what you're saying. So it's around the measure. It's around how, because obviously you'll have uneven playing field if you've got a dynamic team, and therefore you cannot measure them the same way.
Have you ever seen a football team where the players on the same team are competing against each other? It doesn't work. It's a different dynamic. You can have team against team. That's different. Yeah. But
I mean, it's a good point. If you watch the Netflix series Last Dance about Michael Jordan and the Bulls, he goes down that same route, and he actually competes a lot against his team. And so you've got some there's validity around this. And then he realizes that he can't carry the team, and he can't win the game on his own. And even though he's scoring, he's amazing, right? But he still needs Scottie Pippen. He needs Dennis Rodman. He needs all these other guys in order to assist and help him win the championships, which is fantastic. So I get your point on that.
Taking some kudos from now. Like, you're comparing me to Michael Jordan. That's awesome.
Why not? Number 23. We'll get you a nice little blazer.
But I'll just take that one.
And soon we'll have some. Carolyn brings out her own shoes. And yeah, Jordans are still going. Yeah, they're still going.
Yeah.
I mean, last time I checked, he was, is it 2-point-something billion Jordan sitting on? So he's done well. He's worked hard, though.
He's doing
He's doing all right. He's doing all right. These are great points. I mean, I've probably pulled so many nuggets out of this podcast. I'll have to re-listen to it myself. But was anything else on high performing teams that you wanted to, I mean, how do you gauge then? Well, probably my last question on that would be, how do you know you're a high performing team?
For me, high performing means everybody's achieving the best they can. High performing doesn't mean you're winning awards or you're getting recognized by the CEO. It means every person in that team is walking in to their day job, walking out with that same buzz and that same excitement, that they're going in and saying, I accomplished this and I have learned this and I have grown in this way. high-performing teams for me is it's a cohesive unit all working together to deliver outcomes. That is, when I talk about high-performing, it means everybody knows their place in that team and they know how to function in that, and they're growing and their own career trajectory is being launched because of that. That's something that that I'm quite passionate about. I don't like throwing the high-performing statement out and people assuming I mean they're top of the game compared to other PMO teams. For example, I mean they are the top of the game for where they are today, and it's setting them up to be top of the game tomorrow.
Yeah, I love that. I also love the fact that you called Val out. And I think you've actually converted him as well. So that's amazing.
I'm still thinking about my response. So give me a minute.
You know, if you want a clear example of leadership, there's you've just led Val out of the woods, I think. Yeah, we'll have to have Caroline back again to do a whole pod on competition versus friction. But yeah, as we look to wrap up this pod, Caroline, I just had kind of one, I guess, last question, and around leadership, and you spoke about, you know, you jokingly and maybe realistically also want to write your own book around your top tips. But is there anywhere you draw your inspiration from that others might also draw? Are there any books? We always say, you know, people listen to this podcast for the motivation, but maybe they don't. Is there anything that you can share that you personally do and draw from?
I have built really good relationships with some really amazing leaders. And there are some fantastic books out there, you know, and I can send you a few examples. When I am figuring out what it takes to be a leader, there's where I see it. I'm quite visual. So when I see it, I recognize it. It resonates in me and I go, that's good. I want to do that, and I will engage that person and learn from them or put myself in a position where I can absorb more. I am curious about everything. So I'll read, I'll talk to people, and I observe what not to do. And I think as leaders, we can learn a lot from bad examples of leadership, and we can take a lot of learnings out of that and apply it in a really positive way in how we lead. So those are some of the things that I do. I've been very fortunate that I've had some really great examples in my personal life as well as in my professional life as well, where I've seen that leadership isn't about me. It's about the people that I lead, and my responsibility is to make sure that they do their best. And so everything that I seek out and everything that I want to do is to get better at doing that.
Wow, that's amazing. And I guess the best thing about observing others is that it's for free, generally.
Yes.
You don't have to pay to watch bad leadership and or good leadership, and you can learn from both. So, yeah, so that's fantastic. Exactly.
Yeah, but I will send you some of the books and the podcasts that I listen to.
Do that, and we'll post it as part of this podcast. Just to recap, I mean, we covered, as we promised, a whole host of various topics with you, and thank you for that. But just to draw on some of the key conversations we had was, you know, around building PMO teams, also some of your challenges, you know, when you had the little one and trying to juggle both and realigning, I guess, your path, if I can put it that way, to obtain your career goals. And that part particularly stood out for me. And thank you for being so open and transparent about that, because you could really hear it coming through. And we love that passion. And then we went on to a bit of, at the end there, just around leadership. And we love free nuggets, as we call them, and just observing others. That's a free nugget that anyone can just pick up and start doing today. Unfortunately, all we have time for now, as we said, we'd love to have you back for another one. You know, folks, if you want more information, blogs, previous podcasts, check out projectchatterpodcast.com. I want to say a big thank you to you, Caroline, for spending some of your time with us. As I said, we'd love to have you back. Thanks, as always, to Val. Thank you, Val.
And, thanks, guys.
And thank you all for listening to us. As we always say, till next time, stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. Bye for now. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.